Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals the hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Oh, good evening. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. We've got Kirk and JB here this evening. How are you, fellas?
Just great. Thank you. Good.
Yeah, so you were a little north of the impact of Harvey, but Texas just can't handle its rain. I mean, you've got communities where, you know, communities of 100,000 people, and they're entirely underwater. Did anybody in Texas ever think that maybe it wouldn't be a good idea to build a town in a floodplain? Everybody ever heard of that? I mean, you know, you look at this, and you see all of these houses flooded, and you've got, you know, these houses in the Buffalo Bayou, which is the place where water is to collect so that it doesn't destroy downtown Houston. And there's two reservoirs that let water into it, plus the natural flow, but no outlet. I mean, you look at this, you feel sorry for the people that have lost their houses, but you wonder, who in the world is doing planning here? I mean, I just as awestruck by the by it, and then when you see that the principal means of escape for the people is being provided by the Air Force and the Navy, and they're using vehicles that are designed to attack an enemy. You know, they're gunships and armored personnel carriers. And that's what we're using to either airlift or pick people out of communities. In fact, there's right at the border of Louisiana, you see all of these Navy boats that are like the kind of stuff that we used in the riverways of Vietnam. And but it's easy to see how America's going to fail. Now, the only good thing is, you know, there's a lot of images of just ordinary Texans trying to help out other Texans and, you know, going there and they're putting down the street in their boats and picking people up and trying to take them to dry land.
Sure.
But, you know, we look like a third world country.
Yeah. Then you got the idiots who created a run on gas, even though everyone's telling them there's no shortage of gas. This is not causing a shortage of gas.
Right.
But they're freaking out, so, yeah, I had to wait. I was legitimately near an empty tank. I was planning on gassing up yesterday anyways because, yeah, that was payday. And I had to wait 20 minutes in line to get gas because people panicking and filling up 5 containers of gas.
Yeah, it's just amazing. Yeah, it's... You know, the thing that's really going to bring America down is, though, just like the panic on gas here, and I'm sure there's a panic on bottled water and other kinds of things in Texas. There's going to be a panic on the currency. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're not going to be able to take your money out of banks. They're going to preclude you from doing that. And there's just going to be this panic over the value of the currency and being able to get your own money, which the government's going to preclude. And when that happens, confidence in the U.S. government's going to plummet. And people are going to try to get cash, but cash only represents a tiny fraction of 1% of the overall electronic currency of America. So if, you know, at any one time, if 2% of Americans want to cash out on their bank accounts because they don't trust the system anymore, the system craters. Yeah, the system craters. And so that kind of panic is going to play a significant role. And, of course, what the elitists are going to do is to say, all right, you know, we can't give you your money, and we're going to restrict cash anyway, and there's people, you know, abusing it, so you're all better off. We'll keep you safer if you don't, if you can't use cash, because then we can track the bad guys and all those manipulators. And what we're going to do is we'll forgive all debts, but we're going to issue this new currency. And if you want your debt forgiven, then you accept the new currency. People will do it. You know, the average American has $250 in savings and has about $50,000 in debt.
It's easy to get people accept something for free. People love to get something for free, even if it ain't really free.
Right. Oh, yeah, they'll be told that the banks were bad. So what we're going to do is we're just going to forgive all your debt. So your car loans, your house loans, your credit card debt, all of it goes away. All you have to do is accept the new electronic currency. Welcome to the Mark of the Beast. Yeah, and this beast can be really recognizable because the Taurus one that Christians know as the Antichrist will be indistinguishable from Paul. Shaul.
Now they're going to love him.
They're going to love him. Well, Christians are going to love him. He'll be eaten right out of his hand. We want to return to the song that Yahweh asked to sing to us about his beloved and about a vineyard that he is using in a symbolic way to describe his people and their home in Yisrael and what happened to it and who destroyed the intent of that vineyard. And, you know, it's hard for many people to wrap their minds around the idea that man can actually destroy the intent of God. But with free will, that has to be the case. God conceived a plan, and man, religious and political man, has undermined that plan. And this is what
you gotta love
God
the
is
irony.
People.
They don't have a problem with man killing God, but
no.
Interfering in God's plan, they have a problem with.
Absolutely. So this
one's a lot easier to do than the other.
Yes. The religion of Christianity is predicated on God dying. And God dying, it was the Romans that killed God then. And if the Romans can kill God, then Rome was a lot more powerful than is God. And you can't say, well, they didn't really kill him. Well, I guess they did kill him, but then he was resurrected. Well, if he was resurrected, why is there absolutely no evidence of it? Why is it that even in the own Christian New Testament, of the four times that he appears post-death, no one recognizes him? And it's clear that no one recognizes him. It's not the same physical being. Because those people that spent 3 years with him haven't a clue who he is. Each time, he has to re-identify himself. No, but the essence of Christianity is God on a stick. Some religion, huh? I mean, can you imagine being one of these fellows from back in the day, during the high, the know, high water mark of Imperial Rome, or Alexander's Macedonian Greece, or Darius's Persia, or during the reign of Babylon, or any one of the pharaoh, like Pharaoh Ramses of Egypt. And you had, you know, the gods were big. I mean, the gods were the size of the sun. And God had these lofty temples and these beautiful statues. And man, the gods were powerful. And you're looking at the Christian God, and you say, wait a minute. You got him nailed to a stick? That's your God?
Never heard put
hanging before. There dead on a stick? You know, if people were just to take a moment and think about that, and that they show
that
Christianity,
was part of reason.
Yeah, God is shown is either as the dead God hanging on a stick, or as a baby God dependent on its mother. It's just outside of the realm of reason. Well, here's the first. Well, it's the easiest way to control God, and that's what you have to do if you're going to create a religion. You have to be able to control the people's understanding of God. And if you've got dead God and baby God, then of course you need a priesthood to relate to God, to do God's work, because dead God and baby God sure as hell can't do anything. Please, it is my desire out of a heightened sense of urgency. And so I plead with you, desiring your attention, because I want to sing as an expression of my heartfelt desire, using my voice as an instrument to convey the words and musical tones of this song on behalf of my beloved. A song to the one I dearly love, to Dode, concerning his vineyard. Before I read any further, we came to Yeshaya 5 because we had finished Yeshaya 4 and we're trying to progress all the way through Yeshaya 14 so that we can have a comprehensive understanding of the interplay, the interconnection between the Whore of Babylon, Satan, Paul, and the religion of Christianity. So, Whore of Babylon, Satan, the adversary, religion in general, Christianity specifically, Paul particularly, is what we began this 14 chapters of Yeshaya to discover in the book Observations for Our Time. And one of the things that we have come to recognize as we have studied what Yanoah had to say is that there's one person above all people that God loves more than anyone else. Dode.
Yeah.
And here he's singing a song to Dode. And one we think, when we get to the 26th verse of the 5th chapter, Yahweh says, you know, based upon how bad things have gotten, people have forgotten my Torah. He's in the earlier stanza, he's condemned Paul by name, Shaul. And he says, you know, finally, because my hand is still outstretched for my people, he says, therefore, I'm going to lift up this standard that's going to be created in this faraway land on behalf of people from all of the world, Gentiles. And at a very distant time, and we began to ponder, is there anything other than what we are doing that would qualify for that, as the fulfillment of that prophecy? And when we talked about, is there anybody else that has exposed and condemned Paul, because he is named specifically, not for being contradictory of Jesus, because a lot of people have done that, we'll cover that as we move through this chapter, but for contradicting Yahweh in his Torah.
Yeah.
And my understanding is, and I'm open to correction if I'm wrong, I think that questioning Paul is the first ever analysis comparing Paul's comments on the Torah to Yahweh's comments on the Torah.
All right, I think because we're kind of one of the only groups of people out there that really, you know, not only question Paul or look at Paul's words, uh-huh. but also value the Torah. Yeah, there are a lot of Christian groups. Yeah, like there are, I've written several books from Christian perspective that, you know, disassociate Paul, but they do it from the Christian perspective, so the Torah to them is still useless. They, you know, even though they rejected Paul, they still reject the Torah.
Right. And, of course, if you reject Paul, you can't be a Christian. There's nothing left of the religion. Nothing.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting here is there's another thing we have not mentioned yet, and that is that in writing Observations for Our Time, something profoundly important happened, and it began to happen really writing an Introduction to God. And it happened in Introduction to God because of the 119th Psalm, Mizmor, which is an explanation of how to observe the Torah in alphabetical order of the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet in the order that they're presented with 8 stanzas per letter, telling us specifically how Dode, and therefore how we, should observe the Torah. That began our love affair with Dode, with David. And then in Observations for Our Time, one of the things that we constantly reminded of is this interconnection between Dode and Yosha in the sense that they're both beloved sons. Both are the branch. That the father-son relationship is firmly stated and positioned with Dode just as it is with Yosha. And then we came to recognize that Yahweh loves this man so much that when he returns and establishes the 1,000-year kingdom here on earth, it's Dode's kingdom. And so we have come as a family to respect, admire, love Dode. And I don't think there's any other group that has isolated this one man and said, this is the guy, this is the exemplar. He's the one that we need to follow. He's the one that we need to learn from. He's the one that God said he's vindicated, even though he had violated every aspect of the Torah. It was his attitude and his understanding, the fact that he was right with God. And so when you realize this song begins with, this is a song to my beloved, to Dode, and it ends with the banner being lifted up, who else presents Dode this way? And you'll have occasionally a Christian author that will talk about, you know, Dode's courage, you know, to take down Goliath. But there is never a Christian author, I don't think any author, that says the thing that makes Dode spectacular is his understanding of how to properly observe the Torah.
You can't say that as a Christian.
No.
Doctrine
and there's no Jews saying it either. And although they have the star of David, but David doesn't have a star. And they never write of Dode as the person that explains how to observe the Torah, because in Judaism, the Torah isn't observed. It's a Talmud. And it's not Dode that explains how to do it. It's rabbis.
Mm-hmm.
So we are, you know, it's not only that we're the only ones that have exposed and condemned Paul by comparing what he wrote to what God said in his Torah. We're also the only ones that devote enormous amount of energy and effort in sharing insights from Dode. So there's a lot of commonality here. So anyway, this is an ode to Dode and his vineyard. So from Yahweh's point of view, it's Dode's vineyard. The grapes were planted, cultivated, and tended, all existing for him. God, you know, we've talked to this before. Had Adam been content in his relationship with God, that was enough for God. One man would have been enough.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But Adam wasn't content in his relationship with God, and that's why Chawa came into being. And then with Chawa and Adam, they were not so much interested in spending all their time with Yah, and so they chose separation, chose to disregard what he had to say. But you know, Dod alone would have been enough. Abraham alone would have been enough. Isaac, Jacob. God's not looking for this great multitude of people. And Dod, this vineyard, Dod alone, it would have been sufficient. God loved Dod, loves Dod. The grapes were planted, cultivated, and intended, all existing for him, my beloved, to approach and draw near by way of a sun, radiating light from a supernatural source on the Mount of Olives. Keren is the key word there. Keren is that verb and adjective, works both ways, that describes Yahweh's plan when he told Abraham on Mount Moriah with Yishak, don't take the life of your son. I will provide the lamb. And the lamb was described as Keren. Here again, we've got Keren describing the sun, which is the word's primary meaning is to radiate light. And it speaks of a summit, the mount, and the next word is olives. It's precisely where Yahweh said he's going to return, the Mount of Olives, overlooking Mount Moriah. Now, you know, I think that the reason he is not returning to Moriah is he really needs to destroy most of what's there. Mm-hmm. That's the reason. You know, he's going, it is going to be this earthquake that's going to go right through that region, and the water's going to well up, and it's just going to wipe out the Dome of the Hoofy Print, the Dome of the Rock. And the Oxka Mosque. Yeah. And the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Again, we're going to worship death. All of it's gone.
All the religious institutions trying to claim their authority from him.
Correct. All of it's gone. So that's why he's... But he's coming back to Mount of Olives. One of the reasons he also is coming back to Mount of Olives is that what was the ancient world's purest form of light? And how is he coming back? Is he coming back as a physical, material being, or is he coming back as light?
He's ratcheted up light.
All right. So here he is, the sun, radiating light, where? On the mount that speaks of the source of light. He loosened the dirt. This talks about Dod. And why this is next line is important is the reason that Noach's story is known to us is he listened to Yahweh, and he engaged doing what God said. You want to participate in the covenant? Listen to what God said about it and act upon his instructions. What did Dod do? This vineyard existed for him. He loosened the dirt. He tilled the soil. He removed the weeds. He cleared it of stones and planted it with the best vines. Now, why did he do those things? If you don't till the soil, nothing is receptive. Tilling the soil is a metaphor for having an open mind. Removing the weeds is a metaphor for removing all of the contradictory religious notions and political notions that choke out God's message. Cleared it of stone. Nothing grows in stone. Nothing can take root in stone. And he planted with the
best. That's what all of us have done. Yeah, that's why all of us have come to where we are, and all the people we've shared this with, even though it's the same facts, the same material, you know, same word of God, haven't. They haven't cleared those stones. They haven't killed the soil.
No, and you've got to turn over those stones. And you have to till that soil.
They're completely
that's the whole process, really, of searching God's word. Every word, every letter of every word, you've got to turn over. You got to toss the things that aren't good and get rid of all the religious trappings, and with an open mind, work it, work the vineyard. So he loosened the soil, tilled the soil, and removed the weeds, cleared it of stones, and planted it with the best vines. Before he planted it, he did those other things. He built on behalf of the family and son, this is Bana, a watchtower for the observant, a chest for storing important things safely, and a podium on an elevated stage for conveying the message regarding empowering and magnifying growth in the middle of it. Now, I've listed three things. Word Yahweh chose can mean any one of those three things. I don't think there's a chance in the world that he didn't mean all three of those things. The elevated stage is essential. That's the Temple Mount. The elevated stage is important because you want to convey this message from the highest possible point. And it wasn't the sermon in the valley. You know, for Yahweh meeting with Abraham, you know, it wasn't in the ravine. You know, if you're proud of what you're doing, stand tall. Go to a place where you can be heard, where you can be seen, on an elevated stage. What is it what's the chest that's important for storing things that would be in the midst of this vineyard, since it is the Temple Mount?
Well, it's the Ark of the Covenant.
The Ark of the Covenant.
And what's in the Ark of the Covenant?
The Torah.
No, it's beside it. And it is the two tablets of stone.
The two tablets of stone.
Where Yahweh has those three statements that said, you know, here's what you need to know about your relationship with me. And then here's seven instructions about the productive way to live your life. And then beside it, always beside it, is the Torah. But there's more to it than that. The design of the Ark of the Covenant conveys three things that are essential for us to know. And this doesn't get shared nearly enough. The first is, it is a seat. Therefore, when Yahweh says, you can sit beside me,
the throne.
He tells us we have a special place, our own throne besides him, a seat of honor. Well, guess what the seat of honor is? The mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant, right? What's the back of the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant?
That's the wings.
The wings. What do we gain? We become akin to the Malach, spiritual beings. Wings. The wings are indicative of being able to go anywhere at any time at great speed, no longer being limited by the gravity of being a physical object. And it's not just a throne. It's not just a place that signifies of giving us our wings. It is the Ark of the Covenant, and it serves as the mercy seat because it ties the covenant with Pesach, because the blood of the Passover lamb was sprinkled on that seat.
Mm-hmm.
Yosha's blood was sprinkled on that seat. So he built on behalf of the family and son a watchtower for the observer, the chest for storing important things safely, and a podium on an elevated stage for conveying a message regarding empowering and magnifying growth in the middle of it. In addition, he carved out and engraved a wine press and vat in it. Now, God's not just suggesting here that we're growing grapes. No, the grapes are to make wine. Because wine is symbolic of Pesach, Passover. Wine is symbolic of the blood of life. Wine is the beverage that, consumed responsibly, is the principal celebratory beverage of man and has been for 6,000 years. You want to have a banquet, you're going to serve wine. You want to celebrate an event, you're going to serve champagne. Champagne is wine. So it's a wine press and a vat in. But there's another reason for the wine press and wine, and not just grapes, which is that the three metaphors that God uses of organic material to explain his plan, all three of them have the common denominator that they have to be pressed or crushed before they're useful. Bread, grain has to be crushed, ground before it can be made into flour and make bread. Olives must be crushed or pressed before they can make olive oil. And, of course, wine has to be pressed, to be crushed, to make grapes to make wine. And the idea here, too, is that God's not trying to tell us that when we become members of the covenant, life becomes just easy. You know, if you've got, JB, you went through a really difficult period with your legs, your shoulder, all that sort of thing, with your the great motorcycle.
Yeah, that was no fun.
No. It's tough. And you had to do it at a really difficult time.
Yeah, a pregnant wife.
Yes, exactly right. Dode did not have an easy life. And, Dode, for much of his life, was hunted by the king of his country, and he wanted to kill him.
Yeah.
And then Dode was pursued by all manner of foes. God's not saying, I want to make life easy, ever. There's no part of his plan that says easy. Because we don't develop character in easy. We develop character in challenges. And so life should be a challenge. It's how we deal with challenges, how we overcome obstacles, that demonstrates that our relationship and our understanding have merit. It's how we grow. It's how we develop character. And so that's the nature of grain being crushed to make bread and olives being pressed to make olive oil. It's indicative of the kind of life that Yahweh wants us to live. Now, we're going to go to a period where our character is going to have been established, and so we're not going to have those kind of challenges, although we will have a new challenge. And I think the new challenge is a creative one. I think that as we witness the next creation, that we're going to participate not only in the creative act, but have the opportunity to go off and experiment and then share what we have done, what we have learned, how we've grown from it. Then he confidently anticipated the good and beneficial result that would produce clusters of grapes. Hey, you did all the work. This is going to be wonderful. But after all of his effort, it yielded sour and rotten grapes, hard and unpalatable, unripe and worthless, loathsome, stinking, odious, and abhorrent fruit. Now, what caused that? Well, God's going to tell us. Yahweh came up with a plan. And he said, if you follow my instructions, this is going to be great. But if you don't follow my instructions, in fact, if you try to change them, it's not going to be so good. It's going to be rotten, abhorrent. So now, at this point in the story, inhabitants who have settled in Jerusalem and people of Yehuda, please, I implore you to judge, electing to distinguish by making the appropriate connections between me and my vineyard. Responding thoughtfully and appropriately, after closely examining the evidence, making the proper connections, and careful consideration. We spent considerable time saying, why did he say, distinguish between me and my vineyard as opposed to me and man? Well, the consequence of destroying the vineyard was the comparison between Yahweh and man, and he's going to explain that. What he wants you to think about is why he chose vineyard as the metaphor. Why he chose an ark with Noah as a metaphor, for example. Why is it a mercy seat? He wants us to think about this metaphor of vineyard and what it represents. He then says, this next statement is just tears your heart out. What more, additionally, or subsequently, even now, could I have done in my vineyard that I have not accomplished with it? What is the reason I look forward with the anticipation that it would produce good grapes, but there were sour and rotten grapes, hard and unpalatable, abhorrent fruit? God knows the answer. He's not asking
this is a rhetorical
because he does not know. What he wants us to think about is this thing. Back in the day, you know, we had Larry as part of the show before he really showed his true colors, and he was constantly frustrated with why God would go through this whole plan of he himself becoming the Passover lamb and matzah and going into Sheol with his soul. Why do that? Why not just say, hey, you know, you accept the covenant, you're good with me. But what God wants you to think of, why do we have a vineyard? Why did Dode have to till the soil? Why did he have to remove the weeds? Why did he have to toss out the stones before planting and tending these vines? What is it about this story that could be changed? And it's the same story of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim leading to Shavuah. God can't be just if someone doesn't pay the price for our error. And so he came up with a way that he himself could pay the price. Resolve death, resolve sin, cause us to be adopted and therefore resolve separation. And so he's asking through the vineyard, what different could I have done? And then with the vineyard, he's also asking, and this also applies to his means to engage in the covenant. All right, I shared all of this through Dode, this remarkable life. With Dode, we have, 100 Psalms, 25 Proverbs,
at least,
plus enormous amounts of detail about his life in Shamuel and in Kings, Chronicles.
You know, we've talked before about how Dode's a better example than Yahusha. We have way more about Dode's life than Yahusha's. We have way more of what Dode said and did than Yahusha.
Oh, 100 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
100 to 1. You know, it's with Yahusha, we don't have a single place where anything Yahusha said he wrote down for posterity. Not one single word.
Not one word.
With Dode, we have 25.
Not one place where he told anyone to write it down.
Correct. With Dode, we have memorialized over 100 Mizmor Psalms. And they are long, they are detailed, we have them in the original language. And they're acknowledged throughout the biographies. And we have 25 spectacular Mishal Proverbs. All in the original language, all extraordinarily detailed. And then we have all of this information about what he did and what he said and how this applied to his own life in 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Chronicles. And then throughout the prophets, Yahweh is telling us about him. I mean, this is what? Yahshua. He comes up everywhere. We know 100 times more about him than we do about Yahusha. He provides, you know, when Yahusha would get frustrated, people and ask, you know, how do I get saved? He says, what does it say in the Torah prophets? Well, Dode doesn't ask you that question. Dode writes the 119th Mizmor that provides 8 sentences on each of the 22 letters. So this is how you do it. This is what it's all about. There is no comparison, really, between Yahusha and Dode. As a matter of fact, there is no way to know with any degree of certainty what Yahusha did related to the fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim without Dode's 22nd and 88th Mizmor Psalm. And it's the only accurate and complete eyewitness account. which is why Yosha
himself... That's what I point people to. So, I mean, without the Greek text, you know, we have no idea of how he fulfilled them. I got a better description right here.
Right. But
I don't need the Greek text. I know it happened. This is why.
Didn't Yosha, right in the midst of it, cite the 22th and 2nd Psalm?
And tell us to go look at it?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, do you think if there is one possibility in a billion, trillion, billion, gazillion, that Yosha could have been God if he has to ask God, my God, why are you damning me? Why are you separating yourself from me? Why are you forsaking me? Could he have been God and make that statement?
No.
No.
Can't go to Sheol either.
Right. But if he is saying, I'm not asking the question, I'm reading the opening line of the 22nd Mizmor, I'm explaining to you what I'm doing here, then absolutely his soul can be Yahweh's. Because he's telling you, this is what I'm doing here. I'm not asking you a question. I'm making a declarative statement. If you want to understand this, this is the answer. And who's the supplied that answer? Dode? I can't be like Yosha. And all these Christians, I want to follow Jesus' example. No, you don't. No, you don't.
That's impossible.
It's impossible. Can't be done. But, you know, I can measure up to Dode. I can't measure up to him in terms of intellect. But I can certainly try. You know, the way I try is to capitalize on his intellect. I can't live up to Dode in terms of the depth of relationship he has with Yahweh. But I can approximate it because Dode wasn't selfish. He shared every insight that was needed to know to be exactly where he is. When it comes to behavior, I can do better than Dode. So can any of us. We can follow Dode's example. But if you're going to follow Dode's example, what is the single most important part of Dode's legacy? What did Dode leave with us that has the most value? What did Dode contribute to humankind that has the most worth?
His understanding
of the Torah.
And he communicated that how?
In written words.
In writing?
Psalms?
Right. Through the Psalms, through the Mizmor. So, Dode's greatest contribution to humankind is the lyrics of his Psalms that explain in detail the nature of his relationship with Yahweh, who Yahweh is, how they related to one another, and how to best observe the covenant relationship and the Torah.
Well, I would dare say that there's no one throughout the Torah that did anything close to that the way he did, or as thoroughly as he did.
No one. No one.
So why wouldn't he be his favorite son?
Of course.
I mean,
and so if you want to follow Dode's example, are you going to participate in shows like this? Are you going to try to study Yah's word and communicate with your learning?
Word. Huh? Yeah.
Following Dode's example means to orally and in writing study Yah's testimony, share what you have learned, and live your life in a manner that prioritizes learning and sharing. That's how you follow Dode. That is the thing that made Dode unique among men. So, I was saying, you know, shouldn't I have expected a good outcome? You know, Dode was really a smart dude. Dode was really articulate. You know, he's not your average fellow. But Dode was your average guy, your every guy, as it relates to his behavior. And yet, these instructions on this vineyard worked beautifully with Dode, didn't they? So shouldn't God have said, you know, if Dode can do it, you can do it. And with you know, and if you're not as smart as Dode, okay, so none of us are.
No.
He, it's an open book test, and he gave you every answer. Just read it.
This is like looking at your older sibling and learning from their mistakes.
Of course.
Yeah. Younger sibling has that advantage.
It's like your older sibling saying, here's all the things that I did that didn't work out, and I'm writing them down for you. Here's all the things that I did that really had a profoundly beneficial result, and I'm writing them all down for you. And then I'm going to live openly so that you can see me apply the good and bad and the consequence of both in my life. Yeah. And then to have your older sibling be inspired by the creator of the universe so that you can count on everything that you hear from him being valid.
Yeah, he's kind of the greatest big brother in the world.
Correct.
He is.
The greatest big brother in the world.
Yeah, very good.
So God had every expectation. You know, this is tough for a lot of people. They would say, well, how could God expect a good result when, in fact, he got a bad result? Doesn't he know the future? This is one of the things that I've had conversations with Roy on a number of times. And when it comes to understanding time, Roy's much smarter than I am. And one of the things that Roy has constantly said is, if, you know, for there to be free will, and this not to be a mockery, that while Yahweh can know anything he chooses to know about the future, it's much better for him to be selective. It's better for there always to be the randomness, the chaos, if you will, the opportunity for things to go awry, and for him not to witness everything. You know, for example, it's obvious to all of us who are part of the covenant that Yahweh reached out to us before we knew him. And if you look at the history of everybody that's presented in the Torah prophets, the same is true with them. So somehow, some way, through his malach or through his just what he chooses to witness in life, he saw something in us that he liked and that he thought that given exposure to him, we'd follow the evidence. We would capitalize on it. We would engage of our own free will in that relationship. And yet, he couldn't be genuine if he had witnessed our acceptance before he made the overture of invitation. And I think you see that in his relationship with Abraham, played out throughout that. So is it true that God can see any part of the future that he wishes to see? Absolutely. But can you imagine how incredibly boring and painful his existence would be if he in fact did see everything that was going to happen all the way to the very end?
Well, you know, we know he doesn't, because you look at the flood. You know, it talks about him feeling regret. If he knew the outcome at the beginning, he couldn't feel regret.
Right. You know, if Yahweh knew how we were going to grow in our relationship with him, and he went right to the end of it, then all these little things that we've come to understand along the way would have no interest. They would have no value. They wouldn't contribute anything. And yet, every step along the way, now, with every stone we've overturned, with every new insight that we have found, with every word we have more fully and accurately translated, there's been a moment where you could sense Yahweh enjoying that part of the relationship. And the only way for him to grow with us in that regard is for him not to jump to the end in every relationship, but in fact, to let it play out. And that's what he's saying.
Think about it as a parent. You know your kid's going to learn to talk one day. You don't know what their first word's going to be. You don't know what their first sentence is going to be. You know the outline. You kind of know where it's going to go, but all of those first, you don't know the details. And that's where the joy comes.
Let's say, JB, that you won the that big lottery that took place here the other day, and you now after tax have $400 or $500 million, and you decide that you don't have any interest in money. You like your life the way it is, but what you're going to do is you're going to buy a really, really nice piece of property and build a magnificent home for your daughter. And you're going to hire and pay and fund for a lifetime all the people to tend to that house and to the property. And you're going to provide her with every toy that she could possibly want. But more than that, you're also going to give her all of the insights and all of the tools to study the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And you're going to give her the means in her life to be part of the covenant. And if you were to give her all of that and set it all up for her with your whole life demonstrating your love of Yah and give her all the tools that she now, with the best education possible and all the best tools, can go beyond where you have gone, wouldn't you have the natural expectation that something good's going to happen with that? Would you expect her to say, you know, what I want to do is I want to torch that damn house. I want to destroy and replace all of those tools you gave me and all of those lessons, and I want to eat rubbish from a sewer instead.
Well, you know, teenagers can be a bit rebellious.
Yeah, but that's exactly what man has done.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, considering what God was offering and expecting from us in return, he had every reason to expect that we were going to turn out well. So now, henceforth, as a result, please, I am beseeching you, allow me to explain and make known to you what, as a result of the relationship and by way of association, I will do regarding my vineyard. You know, if you're offering this magnificent perfection, immortality, adoption into the Creator's personal family, enrichment and empowerment, and we're being offered all of that through this vineyard, and we instead trample it down and destroy it, God's saying, you know, let me explain what the consequence of that is going to be. So this is what he's transitioning to. Let me say what I'm going to do with my vineyard. I'm going to remove and take away its hedge. Now, that fence that, you know, I gave it to you, but if you don't want it, I'm going to take away the hedge that was designed to keep others out. And it will be purged, it will be grazed, it will be set ablaze. Its protective stone will be broken down and breached, and its stones toppled and scattered by hostile invaders, and it should be trampled down and tread upon. Wow. I think that happened in 70 CE, wasn't the... Yeah, it was home, taken down stone by stone. Weren't the walls of Jerusalem breached both in 70 CE and again in 133? Didn't merciless invaders do this very thing? Break down the walls, topple all of the stones? And then he says, it'll be trampled down and tread upon. But didn't Yahweh make a prophecy about this same Roman Empire that would tread upon the whole world?
Yeah.
And wasn't the whole world as it was presented, it wasn't Sebel, it was Eretz. It's the land.
The region.
Right, it's the land. Speaking of Yisrael, it's the land. And so, he's speaking here of Imperial Rome and the Roman Catholic Church. That's what they did. I shall lay it open and susceptible to becoming a desolate wasteland. I don't think anything can be more desolate than A, what the Romans did, because they salted the land. Or B, what the Muslims have did by building temples to Satan right on the Temple Mount. It will not be pruned.
Telling, because if you look at that region before the nation of Israel came, you know, before Israel returned and really turned that entire region around, it was.
Oh, yeah.
You read any description of it before that, it was a desolate wasteland. It was a desert.
Correct. Yeah.
Mark Twain wrote about visiting the area and, you know, talking about going, you know, days without seeing signs of any life.
Right. Not only did the Romans salt the land, Yahweh says, listen, I'm going to divert the clouds. And he did. It went from being lush to being dry and desolate. Well, you look now at the backside of Jerusalem going down to the Dead Sea. I mean, it's not just desolate. It is lifeless. Nothing grows. I mean, there's not even any shrub brush. It's just nothing but high, hot, dry, dusty rocks. But what Israel has done in returning is they've taken water from the Galilee watershed, and they've brought it down, and they've used the most ingenious irrigation techniques, and they've grown orchards and crops, and they're the primary fruit, citrus in particular, supplier to Europe. They've made it green. They've made it blossom. And even the houses that they have built, all in white stone, they're beautiful. But the areas that
the Muslims live in the region,
But the area that the Muslims live is still a plague.
Yeah.
Still a dump. So I'm going to remove the hedge to keep others out. It'll be purged, grazed instead of blaze. And its protective stone will be broken down and breached, and its stones will be toppled and scattered by hostile invaders. What do the Palestinians name themselves after? The Philistines. Philistine means hostile invader. And it should be trampled down and tread upon. And I shall lay it open and susceptible to becoming a desolate wasteland. And it will not be pruned, nor will it be weeded. And it shall raise up those who exalt Allah, in addition to offering up briars, brambles, and thorns. And concerning the clouds, I will direct rain away from it. He didn't say it'll never rain there again. Just direct rain away from it. It's going to go from lush to desolate. Exactly what happened. The vineyard of Yahweh, the vast array of spiritual implements, is the home of Yisrael. Just in case you were wondering, is he really talking about grapes here? Are we looking for a vineyard? No. The vineyard of Yahweh is the home and the family of Yisrael. That's what we're talking about here. And that's a rather important home and family, because what did Yahweh call Jacob?
Israel.
That's right. Who was the covenant passed down through?
Through Israel. Through
Jacob. Israel.
Yeah.
Who is Yahweh going to reconcile his relationship with upon his return?
Yehudim and Yisrael. And all of Yehudim is Israel, so Israel.
Yeah, Yehudah. Yeah, Yehudah is part of Israel. Although, in Hosea, it's clear that Yahweh sees a split between the
two
and divorced himself of Israel, the 10 northern tribes, because he had business to do, and his heart was just way too close to Dod and Yosha, and therefore he spared Yehudah of that divorce. The vineyard of Yahweh, the vast array of spiritual implements, is the home of Yisrael. And the individuals of Yehudah are the most delightful and satisfying part of the garden. In other words, Kirk, God agrees with you. Yehudah is part of Yisrael. However, Yehudah is extraordinarily more important, more satisfying, more endearing to God. The family of
it's a small subset of Yisrael.
Yeah, actually, I don't
it's
think
a group
that.
A group.
Yeah, I don't think Yehudah is a small subset. First of all, I think that the vast preponderance of Israelites today are still Yehudah. At least I should change that. I should say the preponderance of Israelis today that live in Israel and consider themselves to be Jews are of the tribe of Yehudah. As Kirk found, there are a lot of Israelites living around the world, particularly in Europe, but there's a lot in America that don't know their descendants of one of the 10 northern tribes.
sadly don't even.
Well, there's a reason that they're called Jews today. That's from
right.
Yehuda.
That's correct.
Yeah, that is the majority that survived.
Correct.
But he'll take a remnant out of them too. But Yehuda is still—they got the promise.
They got the
Torah. They got the leadership, the guidance, direction, and all the rabbis, all the others. They gave nothing. They've done almost nothing compared to what Doe did, and a few of the prophets.
Correct.
I mean, we learned everything.
So he expected and looked forward to the exercise of good judgment, to rational thought and reasonable decisions. But behold, now there are violent acts, egregious injustices, and wanton outpouring of blood at the hands of governments and aristocrats, along with a complete disregard for the Torah, and a rational breach of the covenant by many people and nations. Rather than vindication, justice, and prosperity, now there is a crying out for help. What did man do to cause God to say, I'm going to stop protecting the family of Israel?
He became religious.
Yeah, they had a complete disregard for the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
And so, man who disregards the Torah commits egregious injustices and a wanton outpouring of blood. God expected a reasonable response to his Torah guidance. What he got instead was political and religious man. Injustice, bloodshed. An irrational breach of the covenant. And you have to be irrational to breach the covenant. It's the best deal in the history of the universe.
Yeah, it's possible to do that rationally.
Right. And they're calling out for help. They don't even know who to call out to. Do you think that any one of the Israelites that were part of the Holocaust said, Yahweh, I need your help?
No.
Not a one.
Yahweh, I've thought about what you conveyed through Dod. And I want to accept the conditions of the covenant. And even here, to whatever degree I can, I want to celebrate the invitations to meet with you. Do you think any of them? None.
If there were any, it'd be a very minuscule number. But I doubt that any.
My guess is zero.
I would think so. Zero.
Now, what follows depicts today's Israel today as it exists, especially in the area in and around Jerusalem. Tiny plots of desolate land are being purchased from Arabs and cobbled together to build condominium complexes and apartment buildings. These housing units, which are being constructed by the thousands, all share walls, floors, and ceilings in common. Just go and Google real estate in Israel, and you'll see exactly what I mean. There are no single-family homes. It's all of these housing units that share walls and ceilings and floors in common. Yesterday, and a huge percentage of them are being built on land, tiny plots of land that have been purchased from the Arabs. Yesterday, when I was writing this, searching for the proper spelling of the name of the Catholic monstrosity in Jerusalem that serves as a shrine to death based upon something Yahweh said. That would be the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. I'm not good at spelling sepulchre. I was struck by the pictures. You know, if you're going to give the devil his due, you should at least spell his name right? I was struck by the pictures which accompanied the article. There are almost no single-family homes being constructed in and around Jerusalem. Everything is being built just as God is going to describe it. Then this morning, a friend, that would be Kirk, your wife, following the recent Islamic terrorist attacks in Barcelona, Spain, sent this article about how Jews have got to leave Europe, and if they don't leave Europe, now.
That was a scary article.
A scary article, yep. And so the nation's leading rabbi announced that it was time for every Jew to leave, not only Spain, but the whole of Europe. Last year's migration of nearly 2 million Muslims from Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya sealed their fate, and has made it unsafe. Of course, Angela Merkel is chastising other European nations for not taking enough of them. Yeah, it's not surprising that she is the leader of the nation that coordinated the Holocaust.
I've got 100 million people carrying a deadly plague that we have no cure for. Please take them into your country.
There you go. Yeah, that's exactly right.
I'm good.
Yeah,
thank
when they're,
you.
When, yes, when they're living in a situation where they control themselves, where their religion and their political doctrine that's derived from that religion is the only political and religious influence, they're killing each other, gassing each other, raping each other, bludgeoning each other to the point that they can't even survive, and they want out of those areas, but they're going to take that plague with them. And what we should do...
Well, they're doing even worse to those that aren't part of their group.
Correct.
Yeah, that's what they do to each
other. Tolerant, loving,
what
we should bring
those who aren't part of it are worse.
Yeah, that's like a father saying, you know, what we need to do, family, is these racks are killing each other because they've got their plague, and that plague's contagious. But what we need to do is fill our home, because there's spaces in our home we're not using with these rats that are disease-infested and that are killing each other. That'll be a really good
idea.
That'll
work out well.
Yeah.
Trust me, this will work out well.
It's also interesting that while the world is unwilling to hold Islam accountable for perpetrating 99% of the world's terrorist attacks or for abusing 500 million women, Israelis are denounced and condemned for building homes. Sectarians and secularists alike would have you believe that Jews constructing homes are a bigger obstacle to peace than a knife and bomb wielding Islamic terrorists. As a result, and
there are more UN condemnations of Israel than every other nation in the world combined.
Correct. And almost all of them are over them building homes.
Yeah, over, stuff like that. That's stuff that you would look at any other country doing, and you'd go, well, duh, of course they're doing that.
The world is
they're building defenses on their borders? I can't believe that.
The Obama administration did everything they could to completely isolate them as a pariah from the rest of the world. And don't trust Trump as far as you can throw that egomaniac.
No.
He will do nothing.
George W. Bush talked a big game about being allies of Israel, and what did he do to help them? Were they worse or better off when he left office?
Yeah, he gave the people to give
cheap.
Up Gaza. Yeah. He was a Mr. Two-State Solution.
There's an old saying, I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Your actions speak so loud, I cannot hear the words you are saying.
You know, at the time this was written, it was inconceivable. Now it's inevitable. Whoa, this is a warning, oy, to those connecting house to house, field to field, who approach an addition until they are all made to dwell alone, to you in the midst of the land. Now, where's the midst of Israel?
Jerusalem.
You betcha.
Yeah, we're the little
and at this point, they're cobbling together little parts of pieces of land they buy from Arabs, and they're building housing units where house touches house. And
you know, it's interesting.
They're isolated from the rest of the world.
They're not taking this land. They're buying this land.
That's correct. And now, by doing that, there are no more places, and they're all made to dwell alone. The 17th chapter of the same prophetic announcement, Israel will be sent at the waste, and thus at its Carib, indicating its midst, that the nation will be forced to surrender the West Bank, I put that in quotations, it's Judea and Samaria, to the jihadists. As a result, an unstoppable tsunami of Islamic terrorists will flood into Jerusalem, raping, robbing, and murdering their way to Allah. Forewarned is forearmed. There are over 7 million Israelites, mostly Yehudim, living in Israel today, 500,000 of whom call Jerusalem home. But as fast as housing units are erected, they cannot keep pace with the accelerated birth rate and unparalleled immigration. We are rapidly approaching a time when there will be too many people and too few homes. But that isn't the worst of this news. The world in general, and Islamic jihadists in particular, are going to be so egregious, shedding so much blood, that even amidst a housing shortage, the best and biggest homes are going to be abandoned. Well, the previous statement is today's news. The next is tomorrow's. The first phase of what follows is known as the Magog War, the Islamic assault on Israel, the beginning of the tribulation. It's going to occur sometime between 2026 and 2027. It's less than a decade away, and it's going to be horrific. It will be as if hell itself has been unleashed. Satan and his Islamic emissaries will all but annihilate Yahweh's chosen people. Remember, Yahweh said, I've torn down the barriers to keep your enemies out.
Yeah.
It's going to be
protection is gone.
Yes. Do not think for a moment that it's not going to be tread down. Now, that doesn't mean that Yahweh didn't intervene in the Six Days War and in the Yom Kippurim War to overcome 100-to-1 odds so that Muslims didn't annihilate Jews, because had Muslims annihilated Jews in 1967 or 74, then none of this that God is talking about could have materialized.
He has his timeline.
Right. And it's going to play out in his timeline, not the Islamic timeline. And as a result of that, Israel was spared.
But if you think about it, him intervening there gives people that opportunity. You know, it's almost a warning, you can think of it as. You know, he served a warning to them. You know, this is what's going to happen if you come against them, and you still choose to, that's on you.
Yep. Now, when we go all the way to the 26th verse. Now, this is ninth here. We go all the way to the 26th verse. One of the things that struck me initially was I had viewed the entire project from Yada Yah all the way on as an outreach to Yahudim. That was the target audience. I knew that if what I was learning and translating and studying and sharing, if it would resonate with Yahuda and cause Yahudim to reconcile their relationship with Yahweh, to come to know Him for who He really is, and embrace Him, that there is nothing that can make God happier. And if you're doing something that pleases the Almighty, that's a pretty good way to spend your life. But this, the 26th verse, when it talks about that signal, that banner that is being raised for Goyim, and that tore me up a bit. Now, Goyim is people from many different places and many different races. And first thing I want to say, no, it's for Yahudim. But you read this and say, no, it can't be for Yahudim, because they don't respond. There is no way that they can be pummeled, the women raped, the children enslaved, the men killed. This onslaught of the Magog War, it isn't possible that God's going to allow His children to be abused that way. They have to still remain estranged.
Yeah. Otherwise, it would be like the Hezekiah story. They would not have a chance.
So, you know, there are Yehudim, Lisa, Dr. Jeff, and many, many others. The first person that... one of the very few first people to engage. We refer to him as Yoel. That's not his actual name, but Yoel, Jewish. And so, it is possible for a Jew to be considered part of Goyim when Goyim is used in the sense of reaching out to the nations, to people of different races and in different places. But it just means that the target audience of this banner isn't the chosen people, because they're going to be abused. He hasn't put up the barriers to keep out the foes. And if they were tending to the vineyard, they'd be protected. So I am hearing Yahweh of the vast array of spiritual best implements declares that doubtless there will be no houses for many, because an object of appalling scorn and derision, there shall be horrible terrorism and devastating desolation. Even the most beautiful will be without an inhabitant. So he's speaking of these homes. And he says, even the most beautiful is not going to anybody live there. Why?
Right.
Because there will
be
no houses
in
that
field.
Because
it's going to be a war zone.
Object of appalling scorn and derision. And Muslims just despise Jews. They view Jews as the Quran presents them, as asses of men, as monkeys of men, as swine, as objects to be killed, to be swept away. There's going to be horrible terrorism and devastating desolation. That's not what happens to the family. No, I'm a member of the covenant family, not because of what I've done, but because of what Yahweh has done. I simply accepted his conditions. But as someone who is engaged doing what he wants done, exposing and condemning the likes of Muhammad and Paul and singing the praises of his Torah, the 91st Psalm protects anyone who does that. I'm protected. Any of us who do what I'm doing, what we're doing, in sharing Yahweh's message, condemning his foes, just as Dodd did, he protects. Which means that Yisrael doesn't get it at this time. Yahuda doesn't get it at this time because they are not protected. The very protection that we have for ourselves and our family, they do not have, which means they are not covenant. They are not engaged doing what he wants done. Well, that's going to ultimately be resolved, but not early on.
Hey, I've often talked with people about the difference between, you know, everything in Yahweh's word, you know, there's a spiritual and there's a physical element to it. And this is, you know, the difference between physical Yisrael and spiritual Yisrael. You know, physical Yisrael is the actual physical descendants from Abraham. And, Yahweh has, withheld his protection from them, and they are going to suffer the consequences of their own actions.
Correct. And it's going to happen the way they're just talking about.
We fall into that category of spiritual Yisrael. We are not, me, you, Kirk, we're not, descendants physically of Abraham. But we have chosen to accept Yahweh's covenant, and therefore we are still protected by his promise.
Correct. The hedge is still up.
Yep.
Now, just because housing units share common walls, ceilings, and floors does not make them necessarily small nor cheap. A quick search of real estate for sale in Jerusalem reveals that some of these townhouses are large and beautiful with price tags to match, exceeding $10 million U.S. dollars. And while they will be uninhabited because good Muslims, those following Muhammad's pathetic example, are murderous, there will be robbers and rapists, and they're going to flood into Jerusalem by the tens of millions, and because of the robbers and rapists, it will be impossible to live in any of these homes. There will not be enough bullets to stop them. The Jews who are not killed will wish they were dead.
Yeah, that goes back. We were talking earlier about like the 6-day war and how Yahweh has intervened to help keep them. The problem is going to be that they are not placing their trust and their reliance in the right place.
Correct.
You know, they are
Yahweh's
trusting
gonna
in
intervene
their military.
No,
they think their military is what protected them. They don't realize, it wasn't their military that protected them.
Yes.
But that's where
their trust is. Yeah. In this case, they're coming in as a tsunami, a tidal wave is the term that Yahweh uses, and there are not going to be enough bullets in all of the IDF to stop them. And they are going to rape and pillage and rob and murder their way into Jerusalem. Now, Yahweh is going to intervene. He is going to keep a remnant alive. He is going to keep the Muslims from ultimately being successful in wiping out every Jew and destroying the land. And he is going to obliterate Islam. And he's going to do that before the Battle of Armageddon, before his return. So he will intervene. But there's going to be a horrendous price before that occurs. Allah, as Satan, has no capacity to be creative, to conceive or spare life, to build anything worthwhile. All he does is get people to worship him as if he were God, and he's good at killing, destroying, and deceiving. These Muslims are going to epitomize Shema. Appalling scorn and derision, vicious terrorism, devastating desolation, stunning the world with their stupefying ruthlessness. They're going to do exactly what they did in the 100 years following Muhammad's death. While they engaged in terrorism during that time, mostly they were just mass murdering, robbing hordes of crazed barbarians. And that's what's going to happen again. Those who have wielded hammers to build homes will be decimated by those who prefer wielding swords. What follows speaks of Islam's influence over the house of Israel. But then, 10 acres of vineyard shall produce one daughter, a malleable and fragile offspring is what will come from here. That is not what you're going to read if you open your Bible, to Isaiah.
Your Bible?
Yeah. Now, let's talk about this thing.
It took a while to find that, but it's there.
Yeah. All right. So. Before we conclude, and this is the first word I want to deal with is 10 is Asherah. That's straightforward. But Semet, how in the world, I mean, of all the Hebrew words that, you know, we try to quantify in English measures or in the metric system, how in the world did I leave acres as a definition for Semet? Because Semet means an area cultivated by a pair of oxen yoked together and how much they can plow in a day, which is why the word Semet also means pair, couple, and yoke. So before you conclude,
I was just
so amazed by it. Okay, let me share with you. Before we conclude that the amount of land two oxen can plow in a day is a nebulous and antiquated concept, making this prophecy somewhat arcane, you may be interested to know that in the United States today, the official measure of land is an acre, which contains 43,560 square feet. This rather odd number was derived because a pair of oxen yoked together, plow a furrow 1/8 of a mile long, known as a furlong, before the team is turned around to plow in the other direction. Parcels were laid out so that the farmer, starting early in the morning, would be able to finish 2 sets of 10 rounds with a 10-inch plowshare, covering an area of 16.5 feet wide, known as a rod, twice before lunch. They would then water and feed and rest their oxen during the noon break. A second pair of rounds of 10 1/8 mile long furrows would be cut in the afternoon. 40 rounds of 80 furrows plowed over the course of a day by the two oxen covers 16.5 feet, four times 16.5 feet wide, or 66 feet across, by 1/8 mile in length, 660 feet. Do the math. 66 times 66. Zero is, ding, ding, 43,560 square feet, and that's 1 acre.
One acre.
People wonder why I prefer the metric system.
Source of that, by the way, is the University of Nebraska land measure fact sheet. The 10-acre plot being depicted here in this prophecy is therefore 660 feet by 660 feet. Because it's 10 times 66 by 660, right?
Mm-hmm.
That makes it 660, 660 by 660. By way of comparison, the current Temple Mount is approximately 32 acres rather than 10 acres. The south wall is 910 feet, the north 1025, the east 1520, and the west is 1580. Do you think that when Yahweh instructed Dod on laying out this the Temple Mount, that it was actually would call a temple, but it's his home, on the threshing floor of Aruna the Yabusi, that that he had a measurements where every dimension was different? Or do you think that the covenant is square? Four sides, equal length, four is his number. That's the completion of a period
that's
of
perfect.
Rock. Four. Yeah, absolutely. We're talking about Dod's, and therefore Solomon's, mount, or the temple which included the, was called the porch, and the temple itself in an area to walk around them was square. So, what do we have in terms of the original? The size of the trapezoidal shape that I've just given you was a product of Herod the Horrible, is what I call him, who greatly expanded the platform some 2,000 years ago. The original area established by Dod at Yahweh's discretion was square and only about 10 times larger than the footprint of the home and porch combined. To reconstruct its size, all we need to do is look at the platform upon which the Dome of the Rock is now situated and square it off, as Dod was said to have done. The western and eastern facades, inclusive of the original stairways leading to the platform, still exist, all of which were part of Dod's original layout, comprise an area of 660 feet by 660 feet. How about them apples?
Yeah, it's just pure chance. Pure chance. It's coincidence.
Hey, yeah, I looked at it again. No, I don't think it's good sense.
Also,
he's a wondering guy.
Oh, by the way, you know, feet is actually a measure that is transferable. Feet and yards, because yards are meters or a stride. And I was constantly talking about a halak walking stride. And distance, which is cubit, from the human elbow to the tip of our hand, which is our reach, that's essentially a foot and a half. And the foot, which is 12 inches, because that's the length of the average foot, the impression with the foot and the sandal is 12 inches. These are dimensions that have meaning, and six, of course, is the number of man. So 660 by 660 feet. Makes sense. Also, but you can go look at it. I mean, I looked at some 20 depictions of the of the satellite imagery, you name it, of the western wall, the western kind of foundation of the house, the area where the Dome of the Rock is now. Because you don't look at the whole entire Temple Mount, just look at the stairs leading up to the ultimate platform. And the western wall and the southern wall, both 660 feet. Also, considering the fact that Yahweh attributed the original vineyard to Dod, the city of Dod, drum roll please, 10 acres. Now, since Yahweh just stated the vineyard represents the house and home of Yisrael, it is clearly coterminous with the original Temple Mount and equivalent to the city of the Beloved. Below. Now, I'm going to go out on a... Yeah, that's a wowie. On a trend roll here, that would be part of the vine. We're going to stop recording, but we're going to go further in the non-recorded period for those who are listening to the archives and for those who are listening live that want to know. You can listen to the archive when it's posted on any one of the sites, including the Bless Yahweh. YahwehBereth.com or BlessYahweh.com sites.
And so YahwehBereth
sites is a place you can go and listen to what we're going to be talking about that will be recorded but not broadcast. So let's crawl out on one of the grapevines here and suggest that God's not actually talking about grapes. not talking about wine. Not talking about seed.
He's not being literal.
No. No. It's not much of a leap. In fact, himself just said that the vineyard actually represents the home of Israel. Now, beyond this, the numbers don't work out if we were to render Bath, Homer, or Iphah as weights and measures. For example, an extremely unproductive vineyard still produces 20 times more wine than this one if we were to translate Bath as 6 gallons rather than one daughter. By the way, the Hebrew word Bath is daughter. The math works out as follows. A derelict vineyard produces 2 tons of grapes per acre, filling 2 60-gallon barrels with wine, which is just shy of 1,500 bottles, should you be interested in that sort of thing. Therefore, the least productive, mature 10-acre vineyard imaginable would still produce 1,200 gallons of wine, 200 times more than the 6 gallons listed above, if we are to render Bath gallons instead of girls. By comparison, an average 10-acre vineyard would produce 5,000 to 6,000 gallons of wine. And that's an interesting note because a winemaker must squish 700 grapes to get a bottle of wine. The size of a bottle of wine, whether it be in a skin or in a bottle, hasn't changed. 700 grapes.
It takes a lot of grapes. I've done wine once or twice now, and yeah, it takes a lot of grapes.
Yeah, go to any one of the sites for winemaking, and they'll tell you it's. And how many grapes does it take to make a bottle of wine? Answer 700. Grapes are
just used extractions.
Yeah, grapes are propagated via cuttings, not seeds. And while it is technically possible to germinate a grapevine using seeds, to be effective, the seeds need to be refrigerated at a steady 35 to 40 degrees Fahrenheit for 3 months. They must be kept in a greenhouse for 6 weeks to germinate, never allowing the nighttime temperature to fall below 60 degrees Fahrenheit. These saplings have to be transferred into pots and kept in greenhouses until the plants are a foot tall before they're moved into fields. That isn't to say that the grape seeds are worthless, and so seeds is the next term, so you've got to deal with it. Does zera really mean seeds, or is it offspring? You know, 90% of the time that Yahweh uses zera, he's talking about offspring, descendants, and just like 90% of the time that Bath is, he's talking about daughters. A winemaker today can purchase, for about $100,000, a seed separator and dryer, along with another $17,000 for a double-head seed press, and process about 180 tons of grape seeds from the pumice over 6 months' time and yields 12,000 liters of grape seed oil. A ton of grapes, which is about 26% pumice, 572 pounds of moisture skins, stems, and seeds, yields about 70 pounds of dry grape seeds, producing 3 liters of oil. Returning to our anemic vineyard, 2 tons an acre over 10 acres would create 1,400 pounds of seeds. While this is within the range of an average donkey can haul in a cart, which is the measure, that's the Hebrew measure of weight there, which is between 1,900 and 2,100 pounds, with olive trees indigenous and plentiful, and their oil more desirable and economical, especially in Israel, there would have been no reason whatsoever to separate, dry, or transport grape seeds. Moreover, if we are to use weights and measures instead of fragile and impressionable daughters, grapes yielding 6 gallons of wine would produce only 70 pounds of seeds, rendering the donkey irrelevant. So, we're not talking about seeds, and we're not talking about gallons. We're talking about daughters and offspring. Lastly, and by the way, you know, he's already equated this to the family of Yisrael.
Mm-hmm.
So, folks, he's talking about daughters. Lastly, as a dry unit of measure equal to 3 seahs or 10 omers, a ephah is an Egyptian designation. Not ephah. It is only when presented as an adverb an interrogative comprised of eh and paul, that eh paul is Hebrew. In Yah's language, it means what kind of things or which individuals would come from you. If Yahweh was indeed speaking of daughters, at one every 10 acres, jihadists are going to have to either kill or scare away or enslave a lot of Jews. The city of Jerusalem today, with a population of 850,000, 500,000 of whom are Jews, is just over 48 square miles, and thus just under 31,000 acres. This represents 16 Israelites per acre, 8 of whom would be women, 4 of whom might be young enough to be called Baal daughters rather than simply women. If that is reduced to 1 for every 10 acres, there's going to be a mass exodus and massacre.
That's a lot of people gone.
If we were to consider... Yes, a lot of them killed. Many of them all the way to sex slut.
How long did it take you to do the math and research on this part? Because I don't think anyone else has ever done this. What did you think?
I don't think.
3-4 hours tops?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, half a day. Yeah, but a little more than that. A little more than, because,
and
you know,
nobody else has ever taken that time to do that.
No, but it was so obvious to me. He's just told you the vineyard represents the house of Israel.
Yeah.
And when you first come up to acre and you say, oh, man, this is really profound now. And I'm really dealing with acres, and I can know that for certain. And I now know the dimensions of 66 times 6, 60. And I know that he just said 10. That's 660 by 660. And then I look and say, you know, I know he's talking about the original Temple Mount. Mm-hmm. And I look at the images of the original Temple Mount, and the area from the bottom of the stairs to the back and left to right is 660 by 660. I'm saying, you know, okay, there's a lot more going on here. And I read about seeds, and I said, oh, come on. I know zera means seeds, but zera is almost never used to mean seeds, ever. It's always speaking of offspring. And then when I was looking at bath, I said, wait a minute. Why is somebody using a unit of measure here that's gallons of bath? And we don't even know that it really is that's the equivalent, but when 99.99% of the time the bath is used, it means daughter.
Yes, but.
Right, and it was singular. One daughter, bath. And so you start to do that, and it says, well, okay, we're going to have one daughter per 10 acres. What is the, you know, this part of it, yeah, was the 3 to 4 hours you're talking about. Okay. So now that we know that, this part of it for the calculation for what does that mean in terms of reduction? And there's three ways they're going to be reduced. They're going to flee, they're going to be killed, or they're going to be hauled away as sex slaves. Those are the three ways. And so what does that mean in terms of what number exists now versus what number will be in the aftermath of this based upon this prophecy. Now, if we consider the greater Jerusalem metro area, which I think is probably fair, 1,125,000 people, 720,000 of whom are Jews, live on just over 160,000 acres. That's between 4 and 5 Israelis per acre. If half are women and half are young, and by the way, that I'm not just throwing that out. If you look at Israel today, it's 50-50 men and women.
Yeah, that's just looking at demographics.
Right, right. And Israel is not like the Muslim world. You wouldn't have half that are young in the Islamic world. You'd have 3/4.
No, it'd be about 3/4, yeah.
Right. So I'm using Israeli demographics here. I'm not just saying, oh, well, let's just pretend because it's easy. No, these are the numbers. Half are women.
You're not making the numbers fit.
No, that's the numbers. That's one daughter per acre today. Therefore, 9 out of 10, because he was talking about one daughter per 10 acres, therefore 9 out of 10 will either flee, be kidnapped, and dragged away as sex slaves, or die at the hands of Islamic militants. It's no wonder that this was preceded with a woe. These people are crying out in fear. Before we move on, there's something else I found intriguing about Semet. One of the things I like to do, is I like to the word that I'm going to go out on a limb on and really investigate. I like to examine other places where it's used. Well, that's the word I translated acres because that's the primary meaning of the word. But there's a dual nature of Semet. Two oxen yoked together, that's the dual nature of it. It lends it to being used to convey duplicity. It is deployed to predict infamous deceit in Mizmor, Psalm 50:19. And on three occasions, the verb is used to describe the seduction of the Israelites into the worst form of idolatry at Baal-Peor. Under Balaam's suggestion, in concert with Balak, the king of Moab, the Israelites were seduced into becoming initiates into his religious mysteries. As a result, the people worshipped the local god. Baal-Peor is the Lord of Light, Lucifer in today's parlance, while indulging in his prostitution cult. They thereby yoked themselves to Baal-Peor, the Lord of Light, to the whore of Babylon, to Satan himself, and they worshipped Satan as if he were God. The story is told in Bamidbar, Numbers 25:3-5. It's also presented in Mizmor, Psalm 106:28. Now that's telling.
Semet does mean vine and joint.
Yep.
So, yeah, that's
correct.
That ain't a stretch.
In duplicity. That's telling because in Islam, Allah is Satan. And in Christianity, the Lord is God.
Baal is Lord.
That was a rather profound experience, I want to tell you, going through that. Do we want to continue through the end of this since we're recording, or do we want to save it for another program? What do you guys think?
That's pretty good stuff.
That's a pretty powerful stopping point right there.
Okay. Because what we're going to move to is Yahweh begins to warn us about intoxicating beverage. And he ain't talking about wine.
Yeah, I think that's a
good
use
the term wine is not what it means. And then he's going to get into some instruments here. But there's something about each of these instruments that is extraordinarily telling. And we'll just start right there next week.
Yeah, I think this is a good stopping point, and that's a great place to pick up next week.
Yeah. You know, I wrote a number of you. And my question was, this was about 2 weeks ago. I said, all right, we've been trying to learn about the branch. And I've devoted now two chapters to the branch and found out that the branch is synonymous with both Dod and Yosha, and it's a more common title for both Dod and Yosha than Masiach ever was anywhere.
Yeah.
And so it's an extraordinarily important title, and we talked about all the implications of branch and what it means. And there was a place to go that were really compelling. Zechariah, through the first six chapters, all over that story. And it talks about future events, and it's really, really telling, and it's prophetically important. And so... That's the direction I thought, and I had prepared. I've already laid out every passage I was going to translate for that chapter, and that's why I went and said, you know, we returned to our knitting. With the plan of this book was to go through, because we began with two proverbs, Michelle. And those proverbs introduced us to a whore, and to religion, and to Shaul, Paul, of Christianity, and to the Christian religion in general. And how this whore was identified with Satan. And I said, you know, there's one place that I know for certain combines all of these factors. The whore, Babylon, Satan, religion, and Paul himself. That's the first 17 chapters or 14 chapters of Yasiyah. That maybe that's what we should devote this book to. And, of course, we have found things along the way that have caused us to be distracted, and we've been rewarded for those distractions. As I said, do I go to 5? Or
not really a distraction, but, yeah.
And so I read through 5 just in real quickly in a standard English translation, and I saw this banner that was being lifted up. And I saw that preceding it was the story of Beloved, and I knew that had to be Dode. And I saw, just even in the English translation, that there was a mention of Sheol, and that the Torah being rejected, and I'm going, oh my goodness. And I had to obviously translate the English into the Hebrew equivalent, and this banner being lifted up, and I said, is that us? You know, and 2 weeks ago, I just shared 5:26 because it just hit me so profoundly. He's talking about us. We made it into prophecy, which was so humbling and exciting and everything else. And so I decided, you know I asked everybody what they thought we should do, and then universally the answer was, you know, pursue Zachariah. It's got to be a lot more interesting. We're really tired of hearing about Christianity and Shaul and Paul and all this sort of thing. Let's go to something that's really more interesting, and the branch metaphor is really interesting. And when I read that, I knew this is where we had to go. And we've done a lot of things over these last 15 years. This
is profound.
Yeah, this love story
right up there.
Is really, really profound. And that where we just ended it is so profound. God gave us the map to tell us what's going to happen. Wow. And
what I love about Yahweh's prophecy is the specificity of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no other quote-unquote prophet, you know, not speaking for Yahweh, you know, take Nostradamus, everyone loves it. No one was that specific. Nostradamus wasn't specific.
No.
It's a whole lot of, oh, well, this could mean this, and therefore this.
You never see. There's never been one Nostradamus
prophecy.
Right. There's never been a single Nostradamus prophecy that you could predict the future based upon what he wrote.
No. It's all aftermath. It's going, oh,
right, after,
well, he said this, and that matches this that happened, so he was right.
Yeah.
Well, what
the
hell is this prophecy if I can't understand it till after it's happened?
Right. Yeah, I'm telling you that in Jerusalem, there's going to be one daughter for 10 acres. That doesn't mean that 9 out of 10 are going, if you're using Greater Jerusalem as a number, that does not mean that 9 out of 10 are going to be killed. Because some of them are going to know what's coming,
there's
and they're
options.
Going to flee. And we're told a lot of them flee. They flee into the hills of Jordan.
And those are the lucky ones.
Right. So many are going
to
flee.
The dead are the second lucky. And
right.
The third
many
category
are
going to be a lot of them, too.
Right. A lot of them are going to get killed.
That's the worst fate they could face. And that's going to be a lot of them. And that's scary.
Right. So when you really get down into the terms of what he's talking about here, this is just really important. And then, you know, I was thinking about, again, this banner that he's lifting up. No one is talking about Yahshua 5 from any of this, like you were just talking about, just this one statement about acres and daughters and the like, and 660 by 660. Nobody's doing this.
No.
So we're doing.
No one
heard
an hour and not find one other person.
No.
Who has a fascination with this?
And by the way, we're not. You know, if somebody's listening to this and does not know us, then maybe this thing we're trying to claim something that you know that is an important status. No. There is nothing that we would all enjoy more than having the reincarnation of Dode and having somebody whose profound and inspired insights from Yahweh are made available to us, and accurate and complete translations of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, along with a study guide to say, this is what this means. This is how we can apply this to our lives, to do what Moshe did in Devarim. Okay, you've got the first four books. Now I'm going to tell you what all this means, what is important, how we emphasize it, how we apply it to our own lives. And if somebody like that is out there, we're not jealous. We're not saying, oh, no, we really wish that was us. No.
Right.
We would be thrilled.
And my biggest thing when I'm looking at studying anything is I'm looking to find where I'm wrong. That's what I want to know. I want to know where I'm wrong. I don't want stuff that promotes me. Oh, this is, yeah, it's great when you come across those confirmations, but I love it more when I'm like, oh, I was wrong. Okay, I need to change this. I love being proved wrong because I hate being wrong.
Well, like laying this thing out in this kind of a chapter, and you say, all right, Kirk, we're going to show this together. Here is my translation of these. I gave it to you a week ago.
Yeah.
And you made it through what we have just talked about. So I'm laying myself vulnerable if you can't validate.
I went through it. I'm sorry. I would have jumped in a lot more if I had some really good stuff. I do have one coming up in 5:13 I want to ask you about, because I was working on that one between the shows.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about the man being called Magus. And I couldn't get that out of those words. However, here's what I did, and you can tell me how you got to it. I mean, I can find all kind of terrible things that if you keep digging. However, I couldn't find when you use maggot. So I looked up maggot, and there's two Hebrew words for maggot. One of them means exalted also.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's kola, which is devouring the dead. And the and a vine weevil, like a boll weevil, a vine weevil. I'd never heard the term vine weevil before, but obviously they must have. And that was fine, and I could kind of extrapolate from there. Some of the stuff you could extrapolate, and it's not is within the realm of high probability that you're not off the mark on saying something like that. But here was a little funny thing, and these happened to me.
Now, you're talking about the word that's moth, M-O-T-H.
Yes.
Correct. And I have it translated as maggots of men to lowly and insignificant humans, parasitic louses, and the likes of corpses and carcasses.
Well,
you did not find that.
Well, I got a few men of wickedness and falsehood. But I wrote a note over here. I couldn't find maggot. But if you're talking about dead flesh, then obviously that's associated with it. So I only went through seven lexicons.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I couldn't. Usually, I can find just about anything through there, and if I keep looking. But I've only got about two more sources I can go to. But that I don't find as much of a stretch, to use that adjective. So,
there are three principal sources that I use with every single word. And my favorite is the same one, JB. You and I turn to the same
DBL.
The DBL. And Dictionary of Biblical Languages, Semitic, I forgot what they say, but Semitic.
Semitic origin, Hebrew.
Yeah, Hebrew, yeah. And it's, we do it because.
Very comprehensive.
It's extremely comprehensive. It's not published by a Bible publisher. And it's the best one. And it gives you, 1 through 10, here's the meaning. But the other thing is that if a word the primary meaning is something else, and they know that it's translated as by a secondary meaning, they'll put in the primary meaning. And they'll have it all by itself, and then listed next to it will be a secondary meaning or a tertiary meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and it it's the best I have found, too, for scrolling up and down to look at words that are written with the same Hebrew letters. They're just vocalized differently with different diacritical marks. Like the diacritical marks don't exist in the text.
No.
And so I use it. And then I use Strong's. And I use Strong's primarily because, I have found that the verbal root is always easy to identify. Occasionally, Strong's goes further afield than my search does, so I'll use Strong's from that point of view. And then there's the theological word book. The thing that it does that I like is I like it because for every definition, they go through and they say it's used in this to mean that. So they'll give you the reference. So it's kind of like a concordance in a way. They'll give you the reference as to where it was used. The story that I told about Baal Peor. That's from the theological word book.
Mm-hmm.
And so it will give you how the word is used elsewhere where it's defined by that context and shaped and shaded by that context. And it's a fairly honest approach and comprehensive approach if you really want to think it through and you want to define words by how Yahweh himself used them.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the theological word book is written. Is it examines the usage of the word.
Correct.
Yeah, it's not based on a definition. It's not a dictionary. You know, it's going, okay, this is the word. This is how it's used.
Right.
This is where its root word was. This is how that word was used. It just provides so much context on a word.
Right. It's extremely cumbersome to use because if you were to use it as your primary tool, it would take you 45 minutes for every word.
Yeah.
It is a tool to use on the words that are challenging.
Yeah.
It's invaluable.
Exactly.
It is just it's so good. Those are my top three. And then on words
Wait
that still
you got EBL theological word book and what was the third? You mean Strong's? Oh, I've got Strong's.
Yeah, that's the third. So those are the three that I use
for the toughies.
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. We've come to kind of the same conclusion in regard to those three sources, completely independently. I never asked you what you used. I just started buying the materials, and those are the ones that I gravitated to.
My Logos tool is set up to bring up 12, so I have access to 12. And that's the most they'll allow at any one time. And there's times that I use all 12. But
I got some more resources than I do. But
First time I'm always go to the DBL. That's my first go to. Strong's is the second. I also use Strong's because Strong's is more consistent with their transliteration.
Yes.
Now most of the words I can transliterate just by looking at the Hebrew text, and I'll transliterate the word from the Hebrew text itself. But if it's there's a lot of words that are really complex, and so I'll always will give an eye to Strong's for that point of view, and Strong's is pretty good at the root.
Well, okay,
let me tell you the rest of the story.
Most people have access to, so using their transliteration makes it easier for anyone who's looking at what you've done.
That's why I use this. I use the Strong's transliteration. That wasn't my original reason for doing it, although it does. It makes it much easier for the person to look it up.
Mm-hmm.
I use it because Strong's is the only one that transliterates the way that I like to do it, which is if there is an O, show that it came from the wa. If there is an A or an E, show that it came from the A and R.
From the ALF.
So, correct, the ALF. So, there's a more honest, it's an amplified transliteration that's a more honest and telling, complete and accurate.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you one little
transliteration just representing the sound of the word in English.
Let me tell you a little discovery, which means isn't trivial, but it was really kind of fun. It's kind of my little rewards because I couldn't find Maggot, and I found the other ones. And a maggot, of course, is also described as a scarlet or a red worm.
Mm-hmm.
And in there, that comes from Yala and Luala. And And then it becomes one of the definitions, and that's the subset of that is Shani, which is a scarlet-red thread. And then Shina means second. And my little connection immediately, because we were just talking about that about a week or so ago, remember when we were talking about the Zara and Ferris line?
Yes.
And Ferris, of course, is the line that goes through to David, and the other one came in second place, even though it stuck his arm out, and they put a scarlet thread around it.
That's right, exactly.
And then the symbol that they use all through Spain and all through Europe, when the Zaras left Troy, and all through Troy, for that matter, when they left Troy and went to and settled Colcart, the grandson of Zara, became the king of and founded Zaragoza. They had a symbol, they had a flag, and theirs was a red hand with a scarlet thread.
That
means in second place. So Yahweh told you were in second, so no argument.
Yeah.
And they
Example, your analysis of the young and the old lion, and how the lion is associated with Yahudah, because the person who is the who has worked with Yahweh to lift this banner. Is referred to as both the young and the old lion, which means that they have to take on the characteristics of Yahudah in this role. That they're far away and they're Gentile and they roar like the sea, so they're clearly a Gentile, but doing the job of Yahudah. And so you're translating the young and you know the. The young lion is Kapar, which is the basis of Kapurim.
Yeah.
And so the young lion is reconciling. So it's really just interesting to play it all through and see how these various things connect and how something you and I may have talked about one day is then presented right there just as you found it and I found it the next day.
Well, it's one of these things. It is the most wonderful but strangest language I'd never encountered. I'm not a linguist, you know. I think a little German. That was about it. I'm not. I've never seen words that are so interconnected. And yes, it has a positive meaning. A lot of them, and a negative meaning, and then it'll have all these meanings in you. And I write them all down on my little charts, and I'm going okay. And then I won't even think about. How that? Sometimes I look at those and I say, "How the heck could that mean anything? And how? What context would you use that in?" And then you do something else, and immediately you go, "Oh, well, that's why, because it was back there." It's just amazing language.
Yeah,
I don't find
that
in English words.
To it.
I don't find
so many other things.
Words.
Yeah, that we don't get in English, but in Hebrew, there is an analysis towards the end of this, where words that are extraordinarily similar. In their sound, are juxtaposed. One being good, the other one being bad. You know, one being raw, the other one being tob, and yet they're written very similarly, and they sound so similar that that it's part of the poetry of wordsmithing to be able to make these comparisons in a way that would resonate in the ear of the hearer if you're thinking. In Hebrew.
Well, I think it's a disadvantage to someone who has grown up in a Jewish family, Yehui, and you've got all these vowel points, and they put it into your brain from day one. And it's hard. You're like a Christian, like we were when we were Christian. We had to get rid of all that stuff in order to figure out what's what.
Speaking Hebrew puts you at a disadvantage to understand.
I think it does when it comes to translating.
It's one of the reasons I didn't want to do a show where we're actually speaking it is because I don't speak Hebrew. I can read it.
I won't read it, but I'll listen to y'all.
Yeah, and one of the things that struck me is that you've got a Hebrew scholar and they're speaking it, and I don't speak it. I read it. That embarrassed me, and I said, I probably shouldn't do because I don't want. Do I care they embarrass me? No. When I'm trying to convey Yahweh's message, I don't want to be embarrassed because that's embarrassing to the message. Yeah. And so I didn't want to do it from that point of view. And then I just came to realize that speaking Hebrew would be a tremendous disadvantage because you would naturally just
Modern Hebrew
stay.
Is so limited.
I would assume right. I know what that means. Like I there are so many English words and
right.
I never look them up.
You know, like Kara, you'd say, okay, that means to call out. Well, yeah. But it also means to invite and to summon and to meet and to greet and to read and to recite.
And recite.
So what part of that are you going to leave out? Or Asher, that it's a relational pronoun. Well, yeah. But it also means to benefit, to show the way, to provide a path, a narrow and restrictive means to live life. Yeah, it means to be associated with. It means so. Yeah, you can translate Asher as witch. But wow, it means so much more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
And what benefit is that to a Gentile world, for the most part, just listening to this?
Yeah, that's right. You know, that if I were saying it in such a way that I sounded like I was a Israelite, or we sounded like we were Israelites, as opposed to we're acknowledging we're Goyim, fascinated by this, love it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're not Jews.
Yeah. No. I couldn't carry on a conversation with a 2-year-old who is native to Hebrew speaker.
No.
But I can think in Hebrew terms very well at this point.
Yeah, I can't do it. I can think in Hebrew.
Stronger as I go, grow, but yeah, I think in terms of these words, in terms of a translation of these words. Yeah, I've come to understand these terms and their full meaning. And I think that's something that even natural Hebrew speakers don't understand.
Right. Like I read
the
Bana,
nuances of the word.
And I think of what Bana means. I mean, that I realize that while Bath means daughter and Ben is son, that the Bana is basically the feminine of son. Yeah. And I know what the letters look like that comprised it of a family and a sperm. Mm-hmm. And so just to say that it means to build. Well, no, it means to build a family. It means to build a home. You know, and so you look at the word, Bana, but it means to build a family and a home via a feminine influence. And you look at the Hebrew word for family, it's feminine. You look at the Hebrew word for covenant, it's family. And you see feminine, and you see all of a sudden now you're thinking in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
That there's so much more to this word, and you really feel what the word Bana means as opposed to, say, just build. And why Yosha chose that word, Bana, in that statement that is so misconstrued in English Bibles, upon this rock I will build my mikre, my invitation to be called out. And build was Bana. I will establish the family name. I'm going to build the family through the fulfillment of the mikre. Profoundly important and destroyed by Christians. Upon this rock I'll build my church.
Hmm.
So, you know, if you ask
most Hebrew speakers, that's how they're going to give it to you.
It's just built.
They're not going to pick up on the nuance. It's the same thing with the English speakers. We don't pick up on the nuances of most words we use.
No.
We speak in a very superficial way.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh is not superficial.
No. No. There's always a profound word. There's always a superficial message that is accurate. And 99.999% of the meat of the value is not hidden in those words, but has to be
studied for meaning.
Extrapolated, interpreted. Studied, observed. Thought about.
I think that's what Yahweh wants you to do, and that's why there's probably not going to come somebody on the scene that says, hey, here it all is.
No. You know, somebody's going to have to fall in love with Dode.
Yeah.
They really are. To get here, you really need to
fall in love. Yahweh didn't provide cliff notes.
No. By the way, you know what's interesting about Dode, too? He doesn't speak a lot about the Mikra. He observed them.
Yeah.
But this idea that, you know, you don't see him speaking a lot about them, and I think that the reason for that is that that if he was focused on doing them and writing about doing them, it's going to take away from, that's not the right way to observe the Torah. Yeah, we're going to meet Yahweh at these events. Dode met with him at each of the seven events.
Yeah.
But he didn't create a performance religion based upon doing something.
Yeah.
What he was far more
interested in, he pointed us to the Torah.
Behind? Right. What's the meaning behind it?
And the Torah is where we learn about them.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, quite honestly,
that's what it is. You should learn
I think God wants every individual to think about the meaning of each of those 7 days.
Sure it is.
Yeah.
Certain things you just can't be spoon-fed. You've got to think about it. Got to come to it. Anyway, guys, it's getting late.
Great pleasure.
I'm out here in my carriage house. I'm in Virginia today, so I'm going to head back to the house and be with my family. So
both of you.
Yeah. All right.
Enjoy your family. Goodbye, shalom to both of you. We'll see you next week.
Talk to you next week.
Okay, bye-bye.